Bent Sorensen?
Yes, definitely. I think it's for me, I think it's very important when you work with. It's difficult to write a piano concerto and think, but who can play it afterwards? I mean, it's a gift to work with Leif Ove because he's just an amazing musician and because he's so devoted to the music and to create, to try to find the spirit, not only to find the spirit I want to express, but sort of saying to himself, I want to have that feeling. And I think that's when you become a great, great musician. It's not only to say I'm trying to do what the composer wants, but I'm actually want to try to be the composer. I mean, I always think that, and that's not only Leif Ove, it's also the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra. Now I can say something nice to them, because it's very few orchestras where you actually feel that you can you have a feeling that everyone is a part of the same body. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not only me. And then Isabella Terry, who's leading, and then Leif Ove playing the piano. It's everyone who's sort of saying, we are together, we are doing this. And even as a composer, it's very difficult to feel that you become a member of creating something. And I think that has also to do with the fact that when music is created, and it doesn't matter if it's me or if it's Mozart or Chopin or Grieg or who else it is, there is a moment where the composer gets the thought, the idea, the feeling, the music in his head, and then he goes down to the pencil, his hand, he goes down to the paper, and then the musician come, take the paper, go to his hands or voices, and go to his mind, and then it comes out as music. And if you have the feeling that the link is very, very short, that you actually have the feeling that when a violin player is taking the bow to the string or a pianist is putting the fingers, that is the same movement as when I put it on paper, then you are happy. And I think that's experienced both with Leif Ove and the orchestra.
One of the pieces this evening, there will be no paper in front of you. Grieg's Holberg Suite is so much ingrained in your national soul that the orchestra plays it from memory and standing up. It's a very, very rich experience listening to it this morning. What does Grieg mean to you? How many hours have you got?
Well, it's of course one of our national pieces, so it's very nice for us to play it, especially abroad. And it's a piece that you, in its simpleness, it's a piece that you, sorry, that you don't easily get tired of. So you can play it up and up again, and it's still has its values. He's a very open emotional composer, Grieg, we find.
The Norwegian Chamber Orchestra has got a particular version of the Holberg Suite, which I'm very sorry to say we're not going to see in its entirety tonight, but you have a particular version which you commissioned a choreographer.
Yes, we... I've been occupied with the energy and how classic musicians turn out for an audience, and especially a classic orchestra seems very sort of shut out of what's happening, of the whole thing. It's not like in a theater where the actors play directly to the audience. And an orchestra tends to look sort of closed, and the music has a lot to do with it. The conductor with his back to the audience and the musician all glooming at the music they have in front of them. Something is missing. And then we experimented first with playing this piece by heart. And suddenly there was an enormous amount of energy. And in the beginning we didn't know what to do with this energy, so then we got a choreographer to make us use up the rest amount. So we danced and played the piece together, and it actually worked.
So all the musicians were dancing and playing at the same time. Next time you come to the proms, you have to do this. Isabel, as a non-Norwegian playing Grieg, but playing it with a lot of Norwegians, does it have a different feel for you?
Well, it made me nervous in the beginning because I thought they must know better. But I have always said that Russian music is not just for Russians, and it's rubbish that, you know, Dutch musicians can play Dutch music very well. So luckily music is so international, so universal that goes over the borders. And but saying this third movement, you can feel, I think, the and there are a couple of fiddlers in the orchestra, violinists, that do play the Norwegian folk music. So there is definitely something to it. But I would say in the fourth movement, the air, it doesn't really matter whether you're from China or Holland.
The Mozart piano concerto in the second half of the concert, Leif Uwe directs from the keyboard, so he'll have his back to the audience, and it looks rather as if he's sort of driving a car in the middle of the players. And he was talking about the challenges of being the conductor and the pianist within that. How is it for you, knowing that he's got a lot of pressures on him as soloist?
But we help an awful lot. I mean, obviously, it's more leading than, you know, he hasn't got an extra responsibility because everybody knows exactly what is going on. And, of course, rehearsals, but also what we just spoke about, the commitment helps very much to really keep it together and to get the energy, you know, take away a little bit of pressure from him and get it out to the audience. So I think it works wonderfully well. Without conductor. And anyway, I don't want to say anything negative about conductors, but to have the experience in general with this orchestra to play without conductor, again, it's like playing by heart. It's one factor that can distract less. So there's more chance for energy or for something very special to happen. And people listen more carefully, musicians listen more carefully, and there is more space for input as well from the musicians.
Our perception here in the UK of the Norwegian music scene is that it's a hotbed of talent and there's constant creativity going on. Is this true?
Yes.
Terje?
Yes, it's maybe the sport factor and the good money that's done a lot. Also Grand Prix now. Now you can't get a sort of small fiddle for kids anymore because they're all sold out. Because we won Grand Prix last year.
The Alexander Rybak effect.
They all want
effect.
To play, yeah. Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Yeah, it's a good thing, anyway.
Where would you like things to go with the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra? What ambitions do you have for it?
I would like it to develop itself as an important institution of classic music in Norway and abroad. This is very general. It sounds, you know, it's saying like nothing, but it's hard to specify that. I think in our way we want to keep tradition and develop the tradition. And on the other side, the paradoxical side is then to attack the tradition, and then to create fertilizer for new ways to look upon the history.
I've no doubt that the orchestra will continue to create a history of its own, bearing in mind everything we've heard over the last couple of days from them. I was talking to Terje Tønnesen, Isabel van Keulen and the composer Bent Sørensen earlier on at the Royal College of Music. And welcome back from me, Fiona Talkington, to the Royal Albert Hall, where the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra is just preparing the ground for part two of tonight's prom. Leif Uwe Andsnes will be soloist and director of the orchestra in Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24. But before that, they're on home territory, playing Grieg, his Holberg Suite, or to give it its correct title, From Holberg's Time, Suite in the Olden Style. Ludvig Holberg was a Norwegian playwright and philosopher who was born in Bergen, Grieg's own home city, in 1684. 200 years later, a committee was formed to coordinate some bicentenary celebrations, and Grieg, who was an eminent composer with his piano concerto and the music for Peer Gynt behind him, was asked to write a piece. In fact, he was asked to write a cantata to be sung outdoors during the unveiling of a statue in the main square in Bergen. What Grieg actually completed, though, was a five-movement piano suite, which he later orchestrated using French Baroque dance forms, a sarabande, de gavotte, an air, and a final rigodon. Well, there are only chairs for the cellists on the stage. The rest of the orchestra is going to be a band playing right at the front of the stage, standing up and from memory. Grieg's Holberg Suite. Thank you. Holberg's sweetest, sweet in the olden style, in a memorable performance here at the Proms. The Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, directed by Isabel van Perlen, standing right at the front of the stage and performing it from memory. And as the artistic director and founder, Terje Tønnesen, was telling us earlier on, they do another version of this piece. They've worked with a choreographer who taught them the dances to go with the music, and the performances they've given while dancing have been hugely successful. And even this morning in rehearsals here at the Royal Albert Hall, some of the players were saying, we want to do it with the dancing. And actually, you could probably hear there was just a little bit of dancing going on, a little bit of foot tapping and heel clicking in true Norwegian style. Well, this is Grieg inspired by old French dance forms, but he does bring in some very Norwegian sounding dance rhythms too. And there are some hardanger fiddle players in the orchestra who I think were particularly relishing those, the hardanger fiddle, the traditional string instrument of Norway. And I think a performance much enjoyed by the promenaders as well. I bet they would have liked to have danced. Isabel van Perlen, joint artistic director and leader of the orchestra, directing them then. A performance of the Holberg suite. Coming back on and saying, you can't sit here all night and listen to the applause. We've got to clear the platform, put some chairs back on and get it ready for another piece. Got one more bow from the players. Well, the piece we're going to hear next of all is Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24, performed by Leif Ove Andsnes with the orchestra. I spoke to him earlier on during rehearsals and asked him just what's so special about Mozart Piano Concertos.
Well, I'm just so lucky to play this instrument, which has so much wonderful music, but Mozart Piano Concertos are just every piece, at least the last 20, are just wonderful, wonderful pieces, and each of them are so different, and they are... Some of them, like the one we're playing tonight, it's like a mini opera in a way. It's so dramatic. It's so full of theater and life and different voices popping up. It's just the world into itself and very contrasting movements. The first movement is so compact. One can see why this was Beethoven's favorite music, you know, because he uses this motive that he's building the whole movement on, which is not so often for him to do. And Beethoven would continue that line, of course. And then a very contrasting, lovely second movement, very innocent. And then the last movement is just about the best variation piece he ever wrote. And that says a lot because he wrote quite a few of them.
You direct the concerto from the keyboard. What are the challenges for you for doing that?
The challenges I find are often when I start a project like this, I tend to concentrate a lot on the orchestra rehearsal, of course. And then the piano playing might suffer for a couple of days. And then I'm thinking, you know, before the concert, okay, now I have to pull myself together. I have to concentrate on the fine piano playing again and the small movements and so on. So that can be a challenge, that you're using different muscles for conducting and waving your arms. And then the next moment you are doing the fine finger work at the keyboard. But the advantages are also great, because I find that I'm so in the middle of the music all the time. You know, when you play with the conductor, you might sit there and wait for the next passage. And this waiting time is sometimes uncomfortable and not very natural in this music, because this music is so flowing and everything is so interwined. And I'm accompanying the wind players and sometimes the strings, and then I have a solo, and it's all one thing. And then to sit on the side is a little bit unnatural. In the setup now, I'm sitting in the middle of the orchestra with the back to the audience. But with facing the musicians, and we have direct eye contact, and they hear me very well, I hear them very well. And that's important in this music, I think.
But of course, you've got a very special relationship with this orchestra, developed over quite a long time.
Yeah, I find that our performances now are built on trust, that we know each other so well, and we can take chances, and we can make every project special. Because we don't play so often together, but I've done a couple of projects each year with this orchestra, including then maybe a tour, so we've spent a couple of weeks together each time, and it's been just wonderful over the years to develop this, and especially with Mozart, we have done a new concerto each season, and so on. Really special journey.
The pianist Leif Ove Andsnes talking to me earlier on. And here he is now coming onto the stage here at the Royal Albert Hall with Isabel van Curlen to perform Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24 in C minor, K491.
Thank you. Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 24 in C minor, K491, performed here at the BBC Proms by the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, led by Isabel van Keulen, and directed from the piano by the pianist Leif Ove Andsnes. The piano is situated so the keyboard is facing the audience, Leif Ove sitting with his back to the promenaders. Right in the heart of the players, the violins on either side of him. Hugely popular performer, just returning to the stage to thank the orchestra. And I'm sure his name on the programme has contributed quite a lot to this prom being sold out. This particular concerto comes from the spring of 1786, when Mozart had become well known for writing concertos for himself to perform at the subscription concerts in Vienna. That spring, he'd begun work on his opera, The Marriage of Figaro, as well as a shorter opera, Der Schauspieldirektor, and Domineo from 6 years earlier on was being revived, so he was busy making some revisions and changes to that. Well, somehow, in the midst of all that hard work, he wrote this piano concerto, often dark yet very powerful music. Leif Ove just bringing the wind players to the front, and the rest of the orchestra too. This is the man who last night was in jeans and t-shirt at a rock club in the heart of London. And halfway through the evening, he got up, talked a little bit about Chopin, the bicentenary, and played 4 Chopin waltzes. Well, that went down very well. So he was then joined by 3 members of the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, and they played 2 movements of Brahms's G minor piano quartet. The orchestra carrying on to Hamburg tomorrow, an early flight for them, so probably no rock clubs tonight, but I don't know. Leif Ove just returned to the stage once again. I sense there might be a little more music in the air. Thank you. It's a piece which makes people smile, is what Leif Urbansnes said to me earlier on when we were talking about possible encores. The third movement from Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 14 as an encore from the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra, Leif Urbansnes directing them from the keyboard. He said that movement's such fun to play, it's almost jazzy at times. And that's all from the Norwegian Chamber Orchestra for this time, led by Isabel van Keulen, their joint artistic director, with Terje Tønnesen, and Per Christian Skalstad was the conductor in the new piece by Bent Sørensen. There are two treats at the Proms tomorrow night: the BBC Symphony Orchestra playing Sibelius, Samuel Barber, and a new piece by Mark Anthony Turnage. And then later on tomorrow night, it's Jamie Cullum. But that's all from the Royal Albert Hall for tonight. I'll return you to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Fiona, thank you very much indeed. Tremendous stuff. That was Fiona Torkington with tonight's Prom at the Royal Albert Hall. No late night clubs for her either, I suspect. She's back later tonight here on Radio 3, introducing performances just as thrilling and diverse by Bessie Smith and Asta Owaike as part of the lineup in tonight's Late Junction. That's at 11:15 here on BBC Radio 3. Before it, we consider the virtual shadow of Samuel Johnson, with a look at how Samuel Johnson's legacy as the creator of the first great dictionary of English has been developed on the other side of the world in Australia. Johnson Now, His Virtual Shadow, is our essay at 11. And before all that, we're going to head for the movies in just over 5 minutes' time in Moscow to meet the heirs of Eisenstein and Tarkovsky. Movie Nights in Moscow is our feature. It begins at 10.
The Proms on BBC Radio 3. Now, anyone who doesn't know the world of Bruckner symphonies would do well to listen to the Minnesota Orchestra Proms, when they can hear Bruckner's Fourth Symphony, The Romantic, one of his most approachable works, and a wonderful symphony in itself, and that will be conducted by Osmo Vanska. Also, Shostakovich's first cello concerto, a very dramatic piece, which will be played by Eliza Weilerstein, and Barber's music for a scene from Shelley, a typical example of Barber's wonderful way with orchestral writing. Join me, Rob Cowan, as the BBC Proms continue on Friday at 7:30 here on Radio 3.
Well, back to tonight. It's just coming up to 7 minutes to 10, so there's a little time to go before our feature on the changes in cinema in Russia that reflect the changing face of Russia itself. So I thought we could have some Bruckner next tonight on Radio 3. No time for any of his symphonies, of course, but if you're a singer, then maybe you've enjoyed singing one of his lesser-known but very beautiful motets. He was a man of deep faith, of course. He was the organist at the Augustine Foundation of St. Florian and then at Linz Cathedral. But by the time he composed this motet, Bruckner had become professor of organ, music theory and counterpoint at the Vienna Conservatoire. This is Christus Factus Est, and it's sung here by the choir of the Chapelle Royale in Paris and members of Collegium Vocale, directed by Philippe Herrivega.
Thank you.
Christ, for our sake, was found obedient to death. Christus Factus Est, the motet setting by Anton Bruckner, first performed in the Cathedral Square at Linz in 1869, sung there by the choir of the Chapelle Royale and members of Collegium Vocale, directed by Philippe Herefiger. Well, now, before we head to study the silver screens of Moscow, a word about tomorrow morning from Sarah Morpeach.
On Breakfast, each morning through the summer proms season, we'll be bringing you the Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties, in Breakfast on Radio 3, every morning from 7.
Yes, it's surprising how many remarkably familiar tunes and melodies have been introduced to the proms over the years. This is BBC Radio 3. We're broadcasting between 90 and 93 FM and on digital radio and online. The time now is 10 o'clock. And now, movie nights in Moscow. On screen are snowbound landscapes, Soviet-era teddy boys and sci-fi wizardry as Rana Mitter explores new Russian cinema and the new Russia.
When I was a teenager in the 1980s, I saw a new generation of Russian films that truly amazed me. Films such as Come and See and Repentance, which seemed to be asking amazing questions about a political system that was changing beyond recognition. And then, rather like Russia itself, the Russian film industry seemed to go into a decline. It seemed to disappear. Only in the last few years has Russian cinema seemed to revive, producing exciting new pictures from young and inspiring new directors. That's why I've come here to Moscow, where I'm currently standing in the lobby of the October Cinema.
From 2000 to 2008, over those 8 years, you see Russia rising like a phoenix from the ashes to a situation where Russia is among the major film distributors in the world. Major distribution companies invested in the building of multiplexes because they realized that by building proper cinemas, you could actually attract an audience.
Music from Sergei Bodrov's film Mongol, which took Genghis Khan's Central Asian heritage and spun him as a proto-Russian hero. On screen, Genghis Khan gallops thousands of miles in his quest to conquer the world. And cinema in Russia has also been hurtling down a perilous route full of unexpected twists and turns. I want to find out what's happening on screen in Russia today. Recent films touch on everything from villagers to vampires, and the heirs of Eisenstein and Tarkovsky have new visions of post-Soviet Russia that they're keen to project. To understand the story of today's Russian cinema, we need to rewind the reel over 20 years.
When I saw it, I couldn't speak for a few minutes, and that was a general reaction because there was silence normally after the film would end, and then sometimes people would start crying and all that. So we couldn't believe it because that really meant that times are changing.
In 1987, Andrei Ostalsky, who was then a journalist for the major newspaper Izvestia, was in a cinema called Rossiya, watching a Georgian film that transformed not only Russian cinema, but the country itself. Tengiz Abuladze's film, Repentance.
For the first time ever, in an allegoric way, it speaks definitely and clearly about Stalinism and what it has done to the Soviet, Russian, Georgian, whatever people, about this terrible humiliation and the need for repentance for everybody. And what was most shocking was that the authorities allowed this message to be said so loud and clear.
In the Soviet Union, this was the era of perestroika, reconstruction, and glasnost, openness. Earlier copies of Repentance had been confiscated by the KGB. But when the politician Eduard Shevardnadze championed the film, plans to distribute it were debated by the Politburo.
They couldn't decide. Gorbachev was terribly hesitant. He couldn't make up his mind. And then Yakovlev, who was an ally of Shevardnadze and the driving force behind the glasnost, he said, well, let's have a compromise. Let's do two or three copies and show it, you know, in a very limited way and see what the reaction would be. And Gorbachev, who always liked compromises and half measures, he said, let's do this. But then Yakovlev deceived him and allowed 500 copies to be produced and shown around Russia. And then it was shown in very early 1987, and immediately they released the first 140 political prisoners jailed for the so-called anti-Soviet propaganda. How can you keep people in jail for doing something which is now in the film, which is shown in every cinema house? That was, if ever there was an experience of a revolution in art which will bring a political revolution, that was it.
Other landmark films of the Glasnost era included Little Vera, which lifted the lid on domestic abuse, and Plumbum, about a young communist who denounces his own father. But the cinemas went dark at the same time that the USSR, the country that spawned these films, disappeared off the map at the end of 1991. The film critic and academic Birgit Boymers is at Bristol University.
The interest in cinema waned for two reasons. Glasnost and Perestroika had fulfilled their tasks of promoting the changes, political, economic, social, through the medium of culture. A more democratic pattern had been established, which made debates in Parliament, for example, much more interesting to watch than to go into the cinema or the theatre.
So people were watching parliamentary debates on television rather than actually going out to the cinema.
Exactly. And you can see at the beginning of the 90s a sharp drop both in theatre and cinema visits.
As cinemas sprang leaks and screens gathered dust, movie nights in Moscow ended up being endured rather than enjoyed. When the economy went on a rollercoaster ride, the Dom Khanzhonkova cinema, the oldest in Russia, was just one of those that fell into disrepair.
I wanted to see this new Russian film, which went on for 2.5 hours, and went to the cinema to buy a ticket, which cost $10, which was a fortune at the time. There were three other people who had purchased a ticket for the screening that I wanted to attend, and that what we found there was an auditorium which could have seated 800 people, where every other seat was broken, which was unheated. Outside, we had temperatures of minus 25. We had a projectionist who a couple of times lost the reels, missed the pauses, missed the prompts. You know, it was impossible.
You might call it cinemasochism. I mean, really, you have to suffer for art in this particular case.
Yes, indeed, yes. But I think it went hand in hand with a growing video market and piracy.
Moscow has the worst traffic jams I've been in the world. And so it's a great relief, quite late at night now, to be speeding through the city. Film in Russia is many things, but it's definitely become commercial. It's definitely become a business. And that's in tenor with the times. I mean, everywhere across the river you see neon signs lit up advertising the businesses that seem to drive Russia today. The Petrocommerce Bank, Gazprom. Russia's economy reached rock bottom when the ruble crashed in 1998, wiping out the savings of millions. But by the early 2000s, Russia's oil reserves had fueled an economic recovery. Russia became much richer, but it also became much less equal. By the middle of this decade, the only city that had more billionaires than Moscow was New York. At the same time, 30% of all Russians were paid less than the minimum level for bare subsistence. But the re-emergence of a middle class meant a new audience for cinema, and the breakthrough year was 2004. On the international circuit, that was the year that Andrei Zvyagintsev's disturbing, slow-moving and metaphor-rich road movie The Return won the Golden Lion at the Venice Film Festival. But at home in Russia, the film that had them packing the aisles was a very different sort of high-speed extravaganza. Timur Bekmambetov directed A Tale of Wizards and Vampires. It was called Night Watch, and it swiftly became Russia's biggest ever box office hit, making over $16 million. The studio quickly cashed in with a sequel, Daywatch. One of the multitude who saw it was Natalia Ryabchikova, a graduate of Moscow's prestigious film school.
There is a battle there, and then windows start exploding, everything just blows up.
Towering above me here is the Cosmos Hotel, one of the biggest in Russia, indeed in the world. And this hotel had a rather spectacularly messy fate at the end of movie Daywatch, when wizards and vampires who've taken over Moscow somehow contrived to blow up the entire hotel, and actually most of the rest of Moscow along with it.
The hotel literally disappears, and a huge wave goes around Moscow.
Vaporizing the buildings.
Basically, yeah.
Yes, the huge Ferris wheel, which is just placed a little way away from the hotel, it basically starts sort of rolling around.
Yeah, it rolls
comes
around,
off its moorings.
Damages cars, buildings, people run screaming.
I hear that some Russians outside Moscow are not always terribly fond of the capital city. Was there a little kind of thrill of pleasure, perhaps, for all those audiences across Russia seeing the capital city blown to smithereens?
Yeah, I think there was. I think that this scene was actually staged this way to please or to appeal to provincial audiences, because it symbolizes this rich Moscow, this posh Moscow that many people really want to see blown away.
On the other side of Moscow, I met one of Russia's most influential young filmmakers, Alexei Papagrebsky. The cafe in the Mayakovsky Theatre, named after one of the Soviet Union's major playwrights, is where so many of the new generation of movie makers hang out.
Well, this is true. This is the favorite spot for new Russian cinema directors and actors to mingle. And as I say, metaphorically, if somebody decides to drop a bomb, at least half of new Russian cinema would be gone, for better or for worse.
Night Watch, whatever you think of the film, and it's both admired and disliked by different people, was a bit of a turning point. It was a film that brought Russian audiences, in a commercial sense, back to the movies. Is that right?
This is absolutely correct, because that was the breaking stone after which people thought, maybe it's not so bad to go watch a Russian film, because in terms of the return on their money, they were getting as many special effects on the square foot as from any other Hollywood blockbuster. Because people want to be entertained, they want to be impressed. Unlike Soviet times, when cinema, going to films, was the favorite pastime. It was one of the few opportunities to have a diversion or entertainment. And people were going to watch any film. They were going to watch a film about farm milkmaid, for example, or the tractor repairsman. Everything was watched. Now it's really for the younger middle class to go to a well-furnished, well-equipped cinema.
Like a multiplex.
A multiplex. And pay the almost the same money as in Europe to watch a film.
Is it possible to make a film that captures the huge audiences of Night Watch, but also deals with the more gritty realities of life in Russia today? If any place could do this, it would surely be Mosfilm. This legendary studio now uses all the latest technology, but it also gave birth to Soviet classics from Battleship Potemkin to Solaris. The 1990s was a lost decade. Rubbish gathered on the silent sound stages, and stray dogs were reputedly seen wandering around the sets. But today, Mosfilm is firing on all canisters. This is a film studio that's very much aware of its own history. One of the longest continuously running film studios in the world, actually.
It is.
I mean, we've got two quotes, even today, here in 2009. One from Sergei Eisenstein, you know, perhaps still Russia's greatest director, and one from Vladimir Lenin. Now, I mean, Lenin isn't a figure who you necessarily expect to see quoted, particularly on the arts today. Is it surprising to see a quote from him up there?
It's actually the most famous quote by Lenin about the cinema, that says cinema for us is the most important art. So this is the phrase that filmmakers in the Soviet Union have been using for years and years and years to justify their own, well, importance, sort of. The phrase lives on. Oh, here, see, there's a picture of Eisenstein.
That's on the set of Ivan the Terrible, presumably. Exactly. You can see Ivan himself there holding his hand up, and in front of him, a whole variety of cameramen and other stagehands. I've been finding out about Mosfilm's past, but the studio also has a very active present. And a lot of that happens right here on Moscow's biggest soundstage. And it's the size of a football pitch. This is a huge space on which to make the dreams that fuel today's Russian cinema come alive. Lights shining from every angle, from the ceiling, from the sides. You can see how, in the space of just a few hours, just a few days, all the props, the costumes, all of these can be brought together in this space to create one of the dozens of movies that are made here at Musfilm every year. And perhaps those films are part of a wider sense of searching in Russia today, not least amongst Russia's younger people, a generation who've grown up without the certainties of the old Soviet ideology that, of course, brought Mosfilm into existence.
In Soviet period, we have idea. You can say it was bad idea. Yes, okay. You can say it was good idea, somebody said. But it was idea.
Karan Shakhnazarov is a distinguished director who made his name during the Soviet era and is now head of Mosfilm.
Around this idea was the fight. Some life was around this. Somebody supported, and others not support those called dissidents. But I mean, this was the really big idea. Now it's vanished. And so we have, for my opinion, our society have no anything to live for. Because it's impossible to live just for have a lot of sausages in the shops. It's not the real idea for the people, you see.
And is there any prospect of finding that idea? Because it seems to me that some people are trying to look at Russia and try and find out what it means to be Russian in the era after the end of the Soviet Union.
I don't think that they're searching for something like the idea. I suppose or very few of them wanted to find in cinema something what is called idea. Just they want to go to say, entertainment.
So if a young filmmaker came to you and she or he said, I'm really concerned with the way that Russia is going. I see a lot of social problems. I see alienation. I see many social difficulties. I want to make movies about this to wake people up, to alert them, to tell them what's going on. What would you say to that filmmaker?
I will say, yes, go ahead. Go ahead. It's the problem that we have very few such films. So if such a young filmmaker come to me and said, I want to make what all these things, I said, go ahead, I'll help you.
Well, one person who I could have given Karan Shakhnazarov's phone number to was Vasily Sigarev, a young director whose first film looks unflinchingly at contemporary Russian society. At a late-night screening in the centre of Moscow, Wolfie was being shown to an audience of the city's most enthusiastic film bloggers, keen to give their verdict on a film that's already won one of Russia's top awards. Birgit Boymers again.
Wolfie is a film that explores the childhood of a little girl whose mother spends the first 5 years of the girl's life in prison. She's brought up by her grandmother. And when her mother comes back, she abuses the child verbally, pays no attention to her, she mocks her, she's cynical about the little girl. She tells her that you're worth nothing. And yet the little girl loves her mother dearly and devotedly.
It's very much about the problems of Russia today. But there's also another reason why Karan Shakhnazarov might think highly of Wolfie.
Russian cinema is the cinema of images. Russians was who invented images. It's Eisenstein, Dovzhenko, and so on and so. American cinema is the cinema of story in general. Russian cinema is cinema of images.
Sigarev is a playwright, and this is his debut film. But Wolfie is packed with stunning and sometimes disturbing images. There's a shot where spilt milk flows into blood, the red combining with the white, and another where the little girl talks to a gravestone. Or the following sequence in which, in a rare moment of tenderness, the mother gives her daughter a hedgehog.
В комнате оставлю. Пусть бегает.
The little girl, watching her mother perform a series of rather violent and aggressive acts in her presence, the little girl takes the hedgehog and suffocates it. And then what does she do? The hedgehog is already dead and she places it under a running train. And because now it's the train's fault for having killed the hedgehog, her toy, the gift from her mother, she starts throwing stones at the train. the articulation of that need for something, for some response through violence is a very prominent feature both in contemporary Russian plays and in contemporary Russian cinema, and in particular in that cinema which is made by that wave of young new directors who is emerging at the moment.
After the screening, I waylaid Vasily in the cafe upstairs and asked him why so many of the film's emotionally very dark scenes were shot in such a lyrical and colourful style.
The film is based on the girl's memories, and memories of childhood, however bleak, are often bright, bright colours. So I wanted to use that colour scheme to give you a sense of seeing through a child's eyes.
You said, and I understand why, that you don't want to generalise. It's about one story and one character taking her life through. But even if it's just this one story, why is now the right time for this story to be made and shown in Russia?
I didn't want to say something about the new Russia or anything. It's all about the story. The girl is like a modern Mowgli, the Kipling character. She lived for many years with her grandmother. She wasn't taught the difference between life and death. She wasn't taught to love. She loves, but she doesn't really know how to love. This story could have taken place in London or Leeds or Manchester or New York. I think this film is universal.
He's quite right, of course, that the Russians don't have a monopoly on misery, as anyone who's seen one of Ken Loach's or Mike Leigh's more depressing films could confirm. But there's a particularly striking thread of alienation that seems to run through so many of the Russian films of this decade. Family breakdown, corruption and violence are recurring themes. Racism is another. Pavel Bardin's new film Russia 88 tells the tale of a skinhead gang in today's Moscow who end up committing murder. We caught up with Pavel in London, where the film was being screened at the Akademia Russica Russian Film Festival.
It's Moscow, which is not tourist Moscow. It's one part of real Moscow, I think. But we didn't try to represent Moscow in our film. It's not a story about Moscow, it's a story about a human. Это не фильм о нацизме в России. Это фильм об истории конкретного человека.
It's not really a film about neo-Nazism. It's about a person and how these beliefs destroyed his life and his family. The main character is Alexander, nicknamed Blade, and he's the leader of this gang, Russia 88. And he starts playing what he thinks is a game, but discovers it's not a game at all.
Те скинхеды, которых я знал в 93-94 году.
Compared with the skinheads I knew in the early 90s who used to fight each other, go to gigs, fight heavy metal fans and do drugs, today's skinheads are fully fledged underground organizations. Instead of just beating people up in train carriages, they actually murder people. It's not a game like it used to be 10 years ago.
And then you come to the end of the film, where, you know, never mind the kind of confusion between documentary and fiction.
Big at Boymer's again.
You suddenly have a list of over 200 victims of aggression and violence, and you begin to think, hang on, this is actually a major issue.
And I think is it a major issue?
I think it is a major issue. We have seen, certainly in the local news, a lot of reports of attacks against dark-skinned people in particular in the capitals.
The government is keen to dissociate Russia from xenophobia. Nashi is an official youth group which has become controversial because it's seen as close to Prime Minister Vladimir Putin, and it's often stridently hostile to his opponents. Yet despite Nashi's contentiousness, it does have anti-racism and anti-Nazism among its stated goals. However, that sentiment isn't universally shared.
Я, к сожалению, не знаю такой страны, которая не была бы российской в той или иной степени.
I don't know any country that is completely non-racist. In Russia, there is a lot of xenophobia, and unfortunately, the legal system, the police, can't handle all the violence that results. There may be more skinhead gangs and racists in Russia than in most other countries, but no country is perfect. I know there is a lot of discrimination, racial discrimination, everywhere. I've seen it here in the UK, but the difference is, here in the UK, the law works much better.
Russia 88 is just one of the films that depicts life in Moscow. But many of the country's filmmakers have turned their eyes to Russia's vast hinterland. Alexei Papogrebsky is just back from filming in the Arctic, but he shot his first film, co-directed with Boris Khlebnikov, south of Moscow.
Koktebel, for me, was an opportunity and a dream to get outside of Moscow and travel through rural Russia, something that I never done before. So for me, it was a big, big eye-opener, because we started doing those trips back in 1999, at that time when Russia was in much poorer shape than it is now. It was really about, visually and in terms of story, that nothing has changed outside of Moscow.
Нет, сейчас такси возьмем.
Я серьезно.
Ну, не хочешь на такси, поедем на поезде.
Koktebel is a road trip, a tale seen through the eyes of a young boy who rides the rails hobo style across Russia. The start of the film shows minute after minute of the open countryside flashing by from the side of a freight train. Yellow grain, dark green trees, brown soil. The colours of an older, more primal Russia, in stark contrast with the Moscow ring roads and flyovers. The film's lead character seems to embody an almost tangible longing to reconnect with the earth.
If you travel outside of Moscow even now, you probably see places which will remind you of 19th century. They'll remind you of Turgenev and Chekhov. Peasant villages, except they would be called kolkhozniki, from collective farmers. And they are wooden, and they would not have running water, they would go to a well. Some of them might not have electricity, but maybe 2% of them would not have electricity because someone stole the wire. And it will be old people living there. They would not work at the collective farm because the collective farm went bankrupt, and they will basically live on their meager pension and live off their kitchen garden. That's the picture of the country I saw when traveling outside of Moscow, me being a completely urban person at that time, traveling on the route of our characters from Moscow to Koktebel in the Crimea.
Why are so many of this generation of filmmakers drawn to the countryside? I'd heard repeated statements that the rural areas are the real heartland of the Russian soul, and I wondered how seriously to take them. Svetlana Adrubey is director of the arts organisation Academia Russica and organiser of London's Russian Film Festival. She argues that there are particular reasons for the cinematic fascination with the countryside, the village, the land itself.
Pre-revolutionary Russia was an agricultural country, and Russians had deep connection to their land, and this is the root of their relationship to their country, to Mother Russia. Unfortunately, in Soviet times, it has changed because of the collectivization. And now what Russian intelligentsia, Russian filmmakers feel, they feel that Russian land, Russia as a huge territory, is left. No one seems to own this land, and everyone tries to take advantage of this land. So the feeling of responsibility for this land makes them to make films this land. Part of this process of reconnecting themselves to land of Russia, to real Russia, is a sense that the values that were brought by in the 90s by this enthusiasm about the West, these values don't really belong to Russia. They are not rooted into Russian culture. And so part of this filmmaking turning to more provincial Russia is also their way of trying to understand real Russia.
Isn't there something quite romantic, but not necessarily entirely healthy, about the view that modernization and cities and so forth are in some ways not native to Russia, and that agriculture and the the culture of the village are the only place where a sort of pure, genuine sense of Russianness lives? I mean, you can see why that would be attractive, but you can also see why it might be in some ways a rather inward-looking way of thinking about the country.
Yes, but sometimes you need to look inward to regain your identity in a way, to reinforce your identity.
Svetlana Adrubey. And that search for identity is not just a question of geography. It's also bound up with history. In recent years, Russia's been rediscovering its history. Films have been ringing up the rubles with their glossy patriotic take on the past, from 1612, recreating the expulsion of Polish troops